The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit.
Our third case of the day is number 19-443, In Re Torrance. Mr. Bondurant?
Yes, sir. Good morning, Judge King. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Joe Bondurant. I'm here.
Go right ahead, sir.
I'm sorry. Yes. My name is Joel Bondurant. I'm here this morning on behalf of the movement, Mr. Torrance. And the question presented in this proceeding is whether the recent 2254 petition that Mr. Torrance submitted to the court in November of last year is a second and successive petition such that he needs permission from the court to file it. We submit that under the governing analysis, which considers whether or not Mr. Torrance has engaged in abuse of the writ, yields the conclusion that Mr. Torrance has not, in fact, been abusive of the writ and does not need permission, and this is not a second or successive petition. Mr. Torrance was initially convicted.
Yeah. Honor, pardon me for interrupting. I have a procedural question for you.
Okay.
Did you actually file this petition, which you claim to be not successive, but another continuation of the original first petition in the district court?
Did not. No, I was appointed as counsel once it got to the Fourth Circuit, and I was not involved in any way in any of the lower court proceedings, and I don't know that it's been filed in the district court currently.
Well, see, the reason why I asked that is I'm kind of puzzled at this case because the basis for jurisdiction, as you point out in your brief, is for our jurisdiction is 28 U.S.C. 2244, which, as you candidly point out, deals with excessive petitions, which of course you claim that this is not a successive petition, and you may well be correct given all the steps that your client took to try to preserve the claim in the district court the first time that his other claims were being considered. But it's just not clear to me what jurisdiction we have to consider this claim or rule on this issue if the district court has not been given an opportunity to give a thumbs up or thumbs down to your claim that this is in fact a first petition, so it doesn't require authorization from the circuit court. So what's your response to that?
Well, Your Honor, that's an interesting question that I had not considered. I think that the obviously Mr. Torrance filed this request for authorization as a pro se matter initially. I don't think at the time that he filed it, he realized that he had what I believe is a strong argument that it's not a second or successive petition. And, I think there's a case law in other jurisdictions where, the court, I guess I'll answer it this way. I don't know. Since the court has jurisdiction to consider this issue of 2244, there's necessarily sort of a gatekeeping question of whether, in fact, it is subject to 2244, and I don't know how we ever make that determination without assuming jurisdiction over the case for purposes of making that determination. And the other cases that have...
Sort of the way to do it, I would think, is you would file the petition in the district court, obtain a ruling from the district court. Yes, it is a initial petition, a proper first petition, in which case there's no need to appeal, and the petition is considered on the merits, depending on what the government says in response. Or if the district court rules against your client, then at that point it seems proper to come up on appeal to our court. But, as it stands right now, we're essentially, I think, being asked to give an advisory opinion as to an issue that has not yet been fully joined, because no one has said, no district court has told you or your client that you can't file this petition.
Right. Yeah, and I certainly understand the issue and appreciate the question. And it's again, I think the answer is that the 2244, this court has to pass on the question, I think, of whether it's a second or successive. In other words, I don't know that there's any necessary...
Well, we do. We have to pass on the question of whether it's second or successive if someone tells us that it is, because in the typical case, the petitioner is seeking permission for us to file a second, for him or her to file a second petition. But this is a very strange case, because you're saying this is not a successive petition, and you're asking us to opine on that in what I think is a very odd procedural posture. But I've expressed my concern, and we'll just go on and move on, but I hope you understand what the concern is that I have.
Mr. Bondurant, this is Judge King. You're asking for permission. Would it be fair to say if you need it? And if you don't need it, you'll leave it to us to say so.
Yes, Judge King, I think that's another way.
And you'll go to the district court. If we say what you want us to say, and this is a position, I think, a legal position that you, as the counsel that we appointed, you were appointed by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and you say he doesn't need any permission, he can go to the district court. If we agree with you on that, and the government doesn't agree, as I understand it, if we agree with you on that, you're going to go to the district court. If you do that, are you going to go with him? Who's going to represent him then? Is he going to be pro se again?
Judge King, I believe that he's going to, in all likelihood, be pro se again. I may get appointed counsel at that level. I had not, planned it at that point.
You're only appointed for the purposes of this proceeding, correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And so you've taken the position as his lawyer, I assume, and you got him to go along with it, or advised him of it or something, after you got appointed, that the circumstances of this proceeding are such that he does not need permission to file this proceeding, because it's neither second nor successive.
Right.
Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's okay. It's a good question, and I appreciate the clarification. But that is in essence.
I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying that was my perception of it after I've looked at what we have before us here. And,
yes. And you're right. I mean, in terms of your perception of what the argument is and the presentation and the issue, and as you noted, I was appointed just in the appeal process when he presented his pro se petition to the court seeking the authorization. Like I said, I don't think at the time he had any idea that he might not need it. I felt that he thought he was going to need it under 2244, and the Office of Staff Counsel likely reviewed it and thought there was something there.
He filed it as in the Fourth Circuit pro se. And the Fourth Circuit appointed you, and you filed some papers for him, and filed briefs, and we set it for argument, and it's up here.
Yes, sir. That's exactly what happened. Yes, sir.
And if we rule the way you want us to, he can go back to the district court or go to the district court and show him whatever papers he gets out of the Fourth Circuit to go with his petition, I guess.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Bondurant, I don't want to get that horse here, but one of the first things we need to consider is our jurisdiction and the statute 2244 B3C, I think it is, says that the court may authorize the filing of a second or successive application only if it makes the required determinations. It doesn't say anything about a court being asked to opine on whether or not a petition is successive in the first instance, and that's the concern that I have. Now, we have on occasion indicated when a petitioner files a motion for permission, we haven't, I guess, on some occasions said that if a petition is pending down in the district court, he doesn't need permission because the petition is pending in the district court. And maybe this is just an offshoot of that. But in any event, go ahead. We spent enough time on this.
No, I want to follow up on that too, though. I'm with you, Judge Diaz, and I'm not sure we spent enough time on it. But I do think that in line with what Judge King is saying and your jurisdictional concern, essentially the remedy that's being asked, it seems to me, is to simply dismiss this as unnecessary, which you dismiss when you don't have jurisdiction. And I think ultimately that's that would be what would be asked for here, because if I recall, there was a petition that was filed in district court in 2019, but there was no ruling by the district court because you filed this 2244 motion here with the Fourth Circuit. And so when we get something we don't have jurisdiction over, whether for whatever reason, if it's unnecessary, I think simply you just dismiss it. And then that gives you leave to go in, in particular if we dismiss it as unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that this is Judge King again. It seems to me that I have been involved in proceedings such as this, which we have done just what Judge Wynn mentioned, and there's got to be records of them in the Fourth Circuit. And maybe even had them as a single judge. But anyway, I've had meetings like this.
Yes, sir, Judge King. And to follow up on the points Your Honors are raising, you know, if you look at the way the primary case we rely on, the Martinez case, if you look at the way it's analyzed, what the court ultimately ends up saying is that this is not really multiple petitions. This is really all one petition that had multiple claims, and he's entitled to an adjudication of every claim. And to get back to Judge Wynn's point, this claim was filed originally in 2005 as part of the initial petition and was then subsequently dismissed because it was not had not been exhausted. And so nothing has been filed in 2019 in the district court that I'm aware of, but there is the
original. The only thing that's been filed in the district courts of 2005, correct?
As far as, yes, that's correct. And
papers now. 2005, we filed it, and then it was dismissed with a request after you asked for a stay. He did stay in abeyance, and that was denied. So he dismissed count 11.
That's right.
Count 11. And count 11 had not been exhausted, and now he's exhausted 11, and it's And that's why it's back up, and that's over with, he says. And he says he's going to litigate it again. But there was something filed. It was dismissed in 2018, or he finished exhausting in 2018, and he filed this petition, I guess it is, in 2019.
That's right.
But he filed it in the Court of Appeals. That's the point that Judge Diaz is making. He may have filed it in the wrong court. I don't know.
I understand.
But he doesn't have to, if he wants to get, but we're the only one that can rule on whether it's second and successive. And if it is second and successive, we got to give him permission.
I believe that's correct. And if it's not second and successive, I believe you do something along the lines of what Judge Wynn suggested, or perhaps even what Judge Diaz was suggesting, which is you say it's not second or successive, therefore we don't have jurisdiction. And he doesn't need the authorization, but he's entitled to an adjudication of the claim that was properly filed back in 2005 under.
And then you're going to have to go back to the district court, and you're going to have to probably litigate whether there's a statute of limitations that was told or something. But anyway, that's another matter.
I anticipate that's probably be an issue. In fact, the government raised it, and
that's one of the reasons I was asking you if you were going to stick with him. I mean, maybe you may have a lawyer obligation to stick with this fellow.
Yeah, that's certainly something I can discuss with him and with the court and do whatever needs to be done, certainly. And, I heard a sound in my ear. I don't know if that's my time up or not, but that's...
If that's your time's up, we sure took it all for you.
That's all right. That's what I'm here for, to answer questions.
Madam Clerk, does he have some more time?
He has 3 minutes or 7 minutes for rebuttal, sorry.
You want to take
it? Okay,
I'll give you a couple more minutes there. Go ahead. I'll take it upon myself to give you two more minutes, Mr. Bond.
Sure, thank you, Judge King. Yes, thank you, Judge King. I won't take too much time. I can see that certainly the jurisdictional issue is the one that the courts grappling with. I think that, you know, I presented the substantive arguments as well as I can in my brief, and I think the court very well astute on what those are. I don't think that there's any abuse of the writ. Mr. Torrence did everything he could to try to streamline the proceedings and keep it all in a single habeas proceeding. So there's really no way to argue there's an abuse of the writ. The only way I think that he might encounter difficulties is if he steps in some type of procedural snare, like the jurisdictional problem that potential jurisdictional problem we've been discussing. But I just don't believe it's really a problem that needs to hold the court back. The court, if we take it outside the context of where we are now and just think of a subject matter jurisdiction motion, for example, the court has to make a ruling on subject matter jurisdiction, even if it ultimately concludes there is no subject matter jurisdiction. It has to sort of set forth its analysis on why and issue a ruling like that. And this would be very
important. Can I ask a question finally on the merits?
Sure.
So can you think of any other way that your client could have preserved this issue, I mean, other than what he attempted to do in this case?
I don't think so, Judge Diaz. If you look at the way it played out, the allegation is that the Department of Probation and Parole changed his eligibility status in June of 2004. He almost immediately thereafter started his ALJ proceedings in the state court, and within several months started a state PCR proceeding, and within a week of that filed the 2005 federal PCR application that we've been discussing. You know, he flagged everything at that time in terms of the exhaustion requirement and the pending proceedings in state court to meet that exhaustion requirement. And he asked for a stay of the proceedings, which I think, frankly, probably should have been granted under the Ryan Z. Weber case, but there's no indication that was considered. But it probably should have been granted, and then we wouldn't have, you know, this problem before us today. But I think we did everything we could to preserve it.
You could have done. He could have done. He could have tried to appeal the denial of that stay in abeyance.
Well, there was an appeal, and I don't know that issue was raised. But you're right.
Well, he asked for a stay in abeyance as to that count 11, and
yeah.
It was denied for some reason, and he
right.
left it like that. He didn't make an effort to appeal. Now, whether he could do anything on appeal, I don't know, but he didn't try to appeal.
I certainly agree with that, Judge. I would just fall back on the governing analysis, really, which is, you know, is that enough for us to say he's abusing the writ? Because that's the real question we've got to answer on whether or not this is second or successive and whether it needs authorization. Is he abusing the writ? I don't think we can simply say, based on that fact alone, that maybe he could have appealed that procedural ruling on the stay is enough to say he's abusing the writ. I mean, I think if we look at it objectively, he did, with the exception of maybe taking an appeal, he did everything he could to streamline that proceeding and keep it as a single federal PCR proceeding. And I just don't, again, under the governing analysis, just don't see how anybody could objectively say that he abused the writ. But, you know, that is the fact that you brought up there about the appeal. I guess that could be something on the scale against him.
Well,
perhaps,
maybe I find an idea here with the state lawyer. But if your time's up, we'll see what he has to say about it. And then you have some rebuttal time, right?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bondurant.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Now, I've lost my place here, counsel. You're going to have to get going on your own. Let me see. Mr. Buchanan.
Yes, Your Honors. Judge King, Your Honors, may it please the court. Matthew Buchanan with
Mr. Buchanan.
I beg your pardon?
No, your counsel for who do you represent? Identify yourself.
Okay, yes. I'm Matthew Buchanan. I'm general counsel with the Department of Probation, Parole, and Pardon Services in South Carolina, representing the state.
All right, and he's Mr. Torrence is a South Carolina prisoner. I'm with you.
Yes. All right. Well, to begin with, I certainly acknowledge the fact that there's this jurisdictional question, but it's the state's position that this is second and successive. This clearly then falls under 28 U.S.C. 2244. Certainly, B1, where a claim is presented, that was presented in a prior application, shall be dismissed. The language is very solid, that there's no discretion. Does not have to say that the case was ruled upon or the matter was ruled upon. It just says it was presented, which in fact it was. Yes, then it was dismissed. We would say that, yeah, there certainly was that, as Judge Diaz pointed out, could have been appealed. That was not. I think it's a big assumption that to say that they simply withdrew the case, that particular claim, Claim 11, because they had no other choice. That's not really supported by the record. It could have been an attorney decision because the attorney recognized that it was meritless.
I thought he was pro se.
Well, yeah, it was a it was raised pro se. That it was included in a pro se appeal, but then he was represented by counsel. He was appointed counsel, and then that counsel later on dropped that particular claim. Obviously, it was not ripe yet, but we could also just as easily assume that it was not.
It had not been exhausted.
Correct.
It had not been exhausted, and he asked for a stay in abeyance, which the Supreme Court case says that's the way he's supposed to do it. And then he decided to proceed on the other 10 counts and set that one aside and dismiss it.
Correct.
Now he wants to come back and you say that's second and successive. And Mr. Bondurant says it's not second and successive. So that issue is joined here. Now, if we disagree with you, and do we just dismiss it or what do we do?
Well, if you disagree, then I'm assuming that he will eventually try and file that claim in the district court. But particularly for judicial economy, I think it's appropriate to rule upon whether or not it is second or successive now, because obviously if it is second or successive, then you might as well rule that it's a prior presented claim and therefore should be dismissed.
Well, if it's second, if it's not second and successive, he needs to get the Court of Appeals to say so. He has to, under the statute, doesn't he?
Correct.
Okay. So if he can get the Court of Appeals to say that it's not second and successive, then he can do as Mr. Bondurant says. He can go to the district court and proceed, and then you can litigate there with him on whatever issues you want to raise.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Now, the issue, though, because certainly Mr. Bondurant is leaning hard on the abuse of the writ principles, but as we've seen in McCleskey v. Zant, those fall under equity principles. So he's got to come to this with clean hands.
Isn't that the standard for determining the second successive issue?
Precisely. And that's part of the point that I made in my brief, is that he is actually arguing something counter to what he argued at the sentencing court, because he argued during sentencing at the trial court, he argued that he was not parole eligible.
You're getting into sentencing, and that's not in this record.
There was a supplemental.
This record, all we got here is a petition.
I believe that I offered a supplemental record that points out the in the move-in's pretrial brief, page 104 and 105 in our reply attachment number 2. That was because he was facing a death penalty trial during sentencing. His attorney argued that he was not parole eligible and he should therefore be, or the jury should be told that. And then the judge erred, ruled that he was parole eligible and did not present that fact to the jury. Now, it ended up being a harmless error because the judge erred when he did that, because that was contrary to statute. And we can know that this was an error because his co-defendant, also who happened to be his brother, was in fact sentenced to death. And then that sentencing was overturned in Torrance v. State, or, I'm sorry, State v. Torrance, because the judge erred and ruled that he was parole eligible. So here we are. Now he's trying to take advantage of that judge's error by saying he was parole eligible when, in fact, the statute clearly states that he was not parole eligible, and that was the ruling of the Department of Probation, Parole, and Pardon Services back in.
Mr. Buchanan,
yes.
that sounds like a merits argument, though, not just relevant to the question of whether or not this is, in fact, successive.
I submit, though, that this goes towards the clean hands of the equity principles of the abuse of the writ. That's why I submit that this is relevant.
Do you have anything else?
Well, beg the court's indulgence. I believe ultimately, I think I'll go ahead and I'll sum up if there's no additional questions by saying that.
I do want to ask you a question about something.
Oh, sure.
To contradict a fact that seems clear on the record, and that is whether or not this petitioner actually requested a stay in the district court during his first go-around on his initial petition. You seem to suggest in your brief that he didn't, but he clearly did. So I'm not sure what you were getting at. Maybe you can explain that.
I might have inartfully talked about him not appealing that stay, but I certainly acknowledge the fact that he did, in fact, try to ask for that stay, and that was denied.
He preserved the issue that he made a record. He asked for a stay and abeyance,
mm-hmm.
and it was denied.
And that yes, was that's my understanding.
And he did not seek to appeal. Now, whether he had a right to seek to try to appeal that, I don't know. But you said, and I agree with you, he didn't try to appeal. Now, whether that makes any difference here, I don't know.
Well, I think that kind of goes along with the argument that I think it's an assumption to make that the case was simply just abandoned because he didn't have any other choice. I mean, I think it also very well could have been withdrawn partly on the merits so that they didn't tie up the remaining rights.
In fact, he said that he was pursuing the issue raised in count 11.
Yes.
In the administrative law court in South Carolina, and he gave the file number, and he was pursuing it in a state court in South Carolina. And he identified that with the file number. So he was pursuing it in an effort to exhaust the count 11 claim. And he finally, my recollection is that exhaustion wasn't consummated until 2018. And that's resulted in these proceedings that we have here now, where he wants to come back with what was count 11. And you say it's a second successive petition, and Mr. Bondurant says it's not. And that's the issue that we're faced with. That's the only issue we're faced with that I can see.
Correct.
Is it a second successive?
And I would submit that it is, in fact, second and successive. We do have some evidence to show that this was not purely a clean hands equity abuse of the writ, simply because he's arguing something that he counter to what he argued at his original trial, and the statute is
you're going back to the trial on the criminal offenses got him in penitentiary down there, right?
Yeah,
using money hands on this second successive thing.
Right, because he is now arguing something counter to what he was arguing before the trial court, and is trying to take advantage of a very clear error of the judge in saying that he was parole eligible when in fact he was not. The statute 2421640 is very, very clear, stating that parole is not authorized, nor shall parole be given to someone serving
a second or subsequent office. You want us to get into the merits, and Mr. Bondurant says we can't get into the merits. We got to decide whether this is a second successor.
I apologize. It looks like Mr. Bondurant has dropped off the call, so I'm going to go ahead and pause and add him back.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, he's back here with us.
Mr. Bondurant, welcome back. Mr. Buchanan, go ahead.
All right, thank you very much. You're asking that it seems like I'm going into the merits, and I'm only pointing out these things for the context of the abuse of the writ matter, as well as the assumption that the count 11 was withdrawn solely because it was still pending in the state court. That's an assumption. That is not something that we know for sure, because and it could have been a tactical decision by the attorney who was appointed withdrawing it because it was meritless. So that's something that we don't know. It's not supporting the record how or why that attorney came to that decision to withdraw rather than appeal the denial of the stay. So therefore, we would submit that this is a second or successive petition, and the abuse of the writ principles do not apply regarding the argument that it is simply a continuation of the existing petition.
Very good.
All right. Thank you very much.
Judge Wynn, Judge Diaz, y'all have further questions?
No,
I do not. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Bondurant?
Yes, sir, Your Honor. Thank you. I really just got two quick points I want to make in conclusion, and certainly free to entertain any questions. But the first is this notion of why Claim 11 was abandoned. I think it's fairly strongly stated at page 74 of the Joint Appendix, which is the court's order, in footnote 1 says, at the time the R&R was issued, the petitioner was in the process of pursuing an appeal of a decision of probation, as well as a second PCR, which was pending before the Court of Common Pleas, et cetera. So even the court order that dealt with this back in 2005 acknowledges that the reason that count was abandoned was because of exhaustion concerns and the fact that it wasn't exhausted. So I just wanted to note that the record does contain evidence that was the real reason for the claim not being pursued at that time. The second point that I really want to make is to return to this notion of jurisdiction, and because that's obviously a very, very heavy concern on the court's mind. But I think that the way it works, if you, I'll just use the word craft, but take it in the spirit in which it's meant, I think the way that the opinion would sort of be crafted would be, if the court thinks there's no jurisdiction, is to say, movement has sought authorization under 2244. We don't think that this is second or successive under these authorities, these Supreme Court authorities, and that he doesn't need the authorization, is entitled to adjudication of all claims raised in the original petition as stated in the Martinez case. Therefore, since this is not a second or successive petition, we dismiss the case for lack of jurisdiction. I mean, I think there are multiple ways to get to the end result of ruling on the case, but it's not at all uncommon for courts to have to rule on those types of arguments in all types of circumstances where their subject matter jurisdiction is raised, is at issue. They have to sort of make the preliminary determinations on whether they are or are not within the subject matter jurisdiction. And if they're not in this case, I think that very analysis carries with it this notion of, whether or not he's entitled to have the adjudication, because that's the whole point of saying that it's not second or successive. So I don't think that the jurisdictional issue, while I certainly understand, the court's concern and the court's insistence on, you know, protecting its own jurisdiction and raising proper jurisdictional issues. I just don't think that that's an impediment to ruling on these issues, these arguments that have been presented. So with that said, that's all I've got.
Mr. Bondurant, can I ask you a question related to your colleague's arguments dealing with what Mr. Torrance may or may not have said at the penalty phase of his trial?
Yes, sir.
He has a response that his argument is that, well, it's not really a merits argument because the whole basis for your asking us or asking the district court to entertain the petition is not an abuse of the writ for all the reasons he explained in the argument, but that we should in fact consider I'd like you to respond to this issue of whether or not we should consider that information, and if so, whether you have any factual rebuttal or just think that it's just premature at this point.
Yes, sir, Judge Diaz, thank you. I do think that it's factually premature at this point, but I don't want to stand on that ground alone. I don't know that the abuse of the writ doctrine or the analysis is that sweeping in terms of all the equitable, you know, concerns of all time being brought within it. I think if we look at like page 17 of my brief, for example, I've got a block quote from Sanders versus United States, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, which talks about the types of things we're looking at when we talk about abuse of the writ in this context. And what we're talking about generally is people doing things, petitioners doing things that are sort of intended to undermine the streamlining of the process. I mean, that's what the whole Effective Death Penalty Act was about, was trying to give effect to state court judgments because PCR petitioners were dragging these things on indefinitely by doing, you know, they'd file one claim and when it was denied, file another claim. So the whole point of ECPA was to force them to bring them all in a single proceeding. That's the abuse of the writ that the statute was meant to address, and that's when you read the case law, what the cases say, you know, in terms of how you do the analysis and what it's meant to remedy. So I don't think that there's any, I don't know of any authority that says that any and every equitable concern, however couched, might be relevant to this analysis. I just think it's a question of, you know, was this guy abusing the writ, you know, or was he not? And I think under the applicable analysis, he plainly wasn't, because he was trying everything within his power to actually streamline the proceedings, to keep it all in a single proceeding, and that's what the abuse of the writ is concerned with, not just general equity in some ubiquitous sense.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Bondurant, I want to tell you, we appreciate your efforts as court-appointed counsel, and we need lawyers like you that will come in and do this. We appreciate it very much. In this case, will yes, be taken under advisement. And Madam Clerk, we will take another break, and then we'll go to the last case.